The Harlem Renaissance is the name given to the burst of literary and artistic activity that took place in the 1920s and early 1930s. One of the poets of the Renaissance, County Cullen, wrote, "Yet do I marvel at this curious thing to make a poet black and bid him sing." Margaret Walker, James Weldon Johnson, Anne Spencer, and the extraordinary Zora Neale Hurston were part of that movement. One of its stars was Langston Hughes, whose social consciousness permeated his poetry. Here is his poem called "Ballad of the Landlord."
Landlord, landlord, my roof has sprung a leak. Don't you remember I told you about it way last week? Landlord, landlord, these steps is broken down. When you come up here yourself, it's a wonder you don't fall down. 10 bucks you say I owe you? 10 bucks you say is due? Well, that's 10 bucks more than I'll pay you till you fix this house up new. What? You're gonna get eviction orders. You're gonna cut off my heat. You're gonna take my furniture and throw it in the street. You talking high and mighty. Talk on till you get through. You isn't gonna be able to say a word if I lay my fist on you. Police, police, come and get this man. He's trying to ruin the government and overthrow the land. Copper's whistle, patrol bell, arrest. Precinct station, iron cell, headlines in press. Man threatens landlord. Tenant held, no bail. Judge gives Negro 90 days in county jail.
In the Depression years of the 1930s, workers in the great industries of America, in automobiles, rubber, steel, desperate to feed their families, rebelled against the powerful corporations that were dominating their lives. They formed unions, joined the Congress of Industrial Organizations, and with or without the permission of their union leaders, went out on strike, facing police and armies and the National Guard. In 1936, they developed a new tactic, the sit-down strike. Instead of walking off the job, they stayed in the factories and created communities of resistance, defying their employers, the police, the courts. Women played a crucial part in those strikes. Here, Genova Johnson Dollinger tells of a sit-down strike at the General Motors plant in Flint, Michigan.
They used to say, once you pass the gates of General Motors, you can forget about the United States Constitution. Workers had no rights when they entered the plant. If a foreman didn't like the way you parted your hair or whatever he didn't like about you, he could fire you. No recourse, not nothing. After the first sit-down strike started, I went to see what I could do to help. So they said, well, go to the kitchen. We need a lot of help there. They didn't know what else to tell a woman to do. So I said, you got a lot of little skinny men around here who can't stand to be out on the coal picket lines for very long. They can peel potatoes as well as women can. So instead, I organized a children's picket line. The picture of my 2-year-old son, Jarvis, holding a picket sign saying, "My daddy strikes for us little tykes," went all over the nation. Next day, we decided to organize the women. We thought, if women can be that effective in breaking a strike, well, they can be just as effective in helping to win it. At this one point, the police were blocking us, and I thought, well, the women can break this up. So I appealed to the women in the crowd to break through those police lines. In the dusk, I could barely see this one woman struggling to come forward. See, a cop had grabbed her by the back of the coat. Well, she just pulled right out of the coat and began walking down to the battle zone. As soon as that happened, there were these other men and women who followed. See, the police wouldn't shoot people in the back as they were coming down, so that was the end of the battle. And when the spectators came into the center of the battle and the police retreated, there was this big roar of victory. And that battle became known as the Battle of Bull's Run because we made the cops run. Well, we didn't know nothing like that had ever been organized before, at least not in this country. We didn't know we were making history. We didn't have time to think about it. After we sat down in Flint, which is the heart of the General Motors production empire, 15 GM plants across the country went on strike, and the news went out about the role women could play. See, following that strike, the auto worker became a different human being.
When Studs Terkel published his interviews with veterans of the Second World War, he put the title, The Good War, in quotation marks. He was recognizing that in the perspective of history, there were questions raised about the Good War, about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, about Dresden and Tokyo, about the indiscriminate bombing of civilian populations, about the ultimate value of any war, however noble the cause. War was always the killing of innocents, civilians and soldiers. And the military, however good the war, was always corrupt and contained in the best of situations elements of fascism. In his novel Catch-22, Joseph Heller captured the absurdity and cruelty that pervades military life. In this passage, Yossarian's friend Clevenger is facing military justice.
Justice? The colonel was astounded. What is justice? Justice, sir, that's not what justice is. The colonel jeered and began pounding the table again with his big fat hand. That's what Karl Marx is. I'll tell you what justice is. Justice is a knee in the gut. With a knife, sandbagged in the dark without a word of warning, garroting. That's what justice is, from the hip. Get it? Clevenger was guilty, of course, or he would not have been accused. And since the only way to prove it was to find him guilty, it was their patriotic to do so. But it was very confusing to Clevenger. There were many strange things taking place. But the strangest of all to Clevenger was a hatred, the brutal, uncloaked, inexorable hatred of members of the action board. They were three grown men, and he was a boy, and they hated him, and they wished him dead. Yossarian had done his best to warn him the night before. "You haven't got a chance, kid," he told him glumly. "They hate Jews." "But I'm not Jewish," answered Clevenger. "It will make no difference," Yossarian promised. And Yossarian was right. They're after everybody. Clevenger recoiled from the hatred as though from the blinding light. These three men who hated him spoke his language, wore his uniform, but he saw their loveless faces set immutably into cramped, mean lines of hostility and understood instantly that nowhere in the world, not in all the fascist tanks or planes or submarines, not even among all the expert gunners of the crack Hermann Göring anti-aircraft division, or among the grisly connivers in all the beer halls in Munich and everywhere else, nowhere were there men who hated him more.
The end of World War II brought no peace, but an arms race between the United States and the Soviet Union and an intense fear of communism pervading American society. Abroad, it took the form of seeing every revolutionary movement as part of a world communist conspiracy. At home, there was a near hysterical search for communist influence everywhere, leading to loyalty oaths for government employees, secret FBI surveillance of hundreds of thousands of Americans, and congressional inquisitions into the political ideas and affiliations of educators and people in the arts. The House Committee on Un-American Activities decided there was communist influence in the film industry. Informers named actors and directors as members of the Communist Party, and these were then called before the committee to inform on others under penalty of prison if they did not cooperate or of being blacklisted in their profession. Lionel Stander, veteran Hollywood actor, dueled with the committee.
Does the committee charge me with being a communist?
Mr. Stander, will you let me tell you whether you are charged with being a communist? Will you be quiet just for a minute while I will tell you what you are here for?
Yes, I would like to hear.
You are here to give us information which will enable us to do the work that was assigned to us by the House of Representatives, which is a duty imposed upon us to investigate reports regarding subversive activities in the United States.
Well, I am more than willing to cooperate.
Now, just a minute.
Because I have, and I know, some subversive activities in the entertainment industry and elsewhere in the country.
Mr. Stander, the committee is interested in any subversive knowledge you have.
Well, I have knowledge of subversive action. And I can help the committee if it's really interested.
Mr. Stander,
I know of a group of fanatics who are desperately trying to undermine the Constitution of the United States by depriving artists and others of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness without due process of law. If you're interested in that, I'd like to tell you about it. I can tell names and I can cite instances, and I'm one of the first victims of it. And if you're interested in that, and also a group of ex-Bundists, American Firsters, and anti-Semites, people who hate everybody, including Negroes, minority groups, most likely themselves.
Now, Mr. Stander.
And there are people engaged in this conspiracy outside of all the legal processes to undermine our very fundamental American concepts upon which our entire system of jurisprudence rests.
Mr. Stander, unless you begin to answer these questions and act like a witness in a reasonable, dignified manner under the rules of the committee, I will be forced to have you removed from this room.
I am deeply shocked, Mr. Chairman.
In the summer of 1964, black men and women in Mississippi, joined by 1,000 young volunteers from the North, formed the Freedom Democratic Party in defiance of the all-white Democratic Party of Mississippi. When the Democratic National Convention met in Atlantic City, black activists in the Freedom Democratic Party traveled by bus from Mississippi to demand that black people, who are 40% of the population in Mississippi, should get 40% of the seats at the convention. Fannie Lou Hamer, a sharecropper from Mississippi, spoke to the Credentials Committee, citing her own experience about what happened to black people in Mississippi who tried to vote. Her eloquence on this occasion, nationally televised, so worried President Lyndon Johnson that he issued a White House announcement to interrupt her testimony. The Democratic Party refused to seat the black delegates, instead offering them 2 non-voting seats, which they refused. Here's a portion of Mrs. Hamer's testimony.
Mr. Chairman and the Credentials Committee, my name is Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer, and I live at 626 East Lafayette Street, Ruleville, Mississippi, Sunflower County, the home of Senator James O. Eastland and Senator Stennis. It was the 31st of August in 1962 that 18 of us traveled 26 miles to the county courthouse in Indianola to try to register to vote to become first-class citizens. The plantation owner came and said, "Fannie Lou, if you don't go down and withdraw your registration, you will have to leave because we are not ready for that in Mississippi." And I addressed him and told him, I said, "I didn't go down there to register for you. I went down to register for myself." I had to leave that same night. And in June the 9th, 1963, I had attended a voter registration workshop, was returning back to Mississippi. 10 of us was traveling by Continental Trailway bus. When we got to Winona, Mississippi, there was a state highway patrolman and a chief of police ordered us out. When they found out who I was, they said, "You nigga bitch, we gonna make you wish you were dead." They made me lay on my face and they ordered two Negro prisoners to beat me with a blackjack. That was unbearable. The first prisoner beat me until he was exhausted, and then the second Negro began to beat me. They beat me until I was hard, until I couldn't bend my fingers or get up when they told me to. All of this on account that we wanted to register to vote, to become first-class citizens. And if the Freedom Democratic Party is not seated now, I question America. Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off the hooks because our lives be threatened daily because we want to live as decent human beings in America? I thank you.
In the struggle for racial equality, not all black people accepted Martin Luther King's message of love and nonviolence. Soon after the 1963 March on Washington, in which King spoke of his dream, four black girls were killed in the bombing of a Birmingham church. For Malcolm X, who grew up in a northern ghetto, spent time in prison, became a Muslim, this pointed up the limitations of the civil rights movement. That fall, he addressed a meeting in Detroit. 2 years later, he would be assassinated.
"As long as the white man sent you to Korea, you bled. He sent you to Germany, you bled. He sent you to the South Pacific to fight the Japanese, you bled. You bleed for the white man. But when it comes to seeing your own churches being bombed and little black girls murdered, you haven't got any blood. You bleed when the white man says bleed. You bite when the white man says bite, and you bark when the white man says bark. I hate to say this about us, but it's true. How are you going to be nonviolent in Mississippi and violent as you were in Korea? How can you justify being nonviolent in Mississippi and Alabama when your churches are being bombed and your little girls are being murdered? If violence is wrong in America, violence is wrong abroad. If it is wrong to be violent defending black women and black children and black babies and black men, then it is wrong for America to draft us and make us violent abroad to defend her. And if it is right for America to draft us and teach us how to be violent in defense of her, then it is right for you and me to do whatever is necessary to defend our own people right here in this country." Right at that time, Birmingham had exploded. That's when Kennedy sent in the troops down in Birmingham. After that, Kennedy got on the television and said, "This is a moral issue." That's when he said he was going to put out a civil rights bill. When he mentioned civil rights bill, and the Southern crackers started talking about how they were going to boycott and filibuster it, then the Negroes started talking about how they were going to march on Washington, march on the Senate, march on the White House, march on the Congress, tied up. bring it to a halt, not let the government proceed. They even said they were going to go out to the airport and lie down on the runway, not let any airplanes land. I'm telling you what they said. That was revolution. That was revolution. That was the Black Revolution. It was the grassroots out there in the street. It scared the white man to death, scared the white power structure in Washington, D.C. to death. I was there when they found out that this black steamroller was going to come down on the Capitol. They called in those national Negro leaders that you respect and said, call it off. Kennedy said, look, you're letting this go too far. And old Tom said, boss, I can't stop it because I didn't start it. I'm telling you what they said. They said, I'm not even in it, much less at the head of it. They said, these Negroes are doing things on their own.
Many of the national leaders of the civil rights movement thought they should not speak out about the war in Vietnam, that this would hurt the cause of black people. But Martin Luther King Jr. decided he could not be silent. April 4th, 1967, he spoke at the Riverside Church in New York.
I come to this magnificent house of worship tonight because my conscience leaves me no other choice. A time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us in relationship to Vietnam. In 1957, when a group of us formed the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, we chose as our motto to save the soul of America. In a way, we were agreeing with Langston Hughes, the black bard of Harlem, who had written earlier, oh yes, I say it plain, America was never America to me, and yet I swear this oath America will be. Somehow this madness must cease. We must stop now. I speak as a child of God and brother to the suffering poor of Vietnam. I speak for those whose land is being laid waste, whose homes are being destroyed, whose culture is being subverted. I speak for the poor of America who are paying the double price of smashed hopes at home and dealt death and corruption in Vietnam. I speak as a citizen of the world, for the world as it stands aghast at the path we have taken. I speak as one who loves America, to the leaders of our own nation. The great initiative in this war is ours. The initiative to stop it must be ours. I am convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-orientated society to a person-orientated society. When machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplet of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism are inescapable of being conquered. A true revolution of values will soon look uneasy on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth. The Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just. A true revolution of values will lay hand on the world order and say of war, this way of settling differences is not just. This business of burning human beings with napalm, of filling our nation's homes with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of peoples normally humane, of sending men from dark and bloody battlefields, physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. Now let us begin. Now let us rededicate ourselves to the long and bitter but beautiful struggle for a new world.
The rebellious spirit of the 60s showed itself not only in the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement, but an unprecedented emergence of a movement for gay and lesbian rights, and also an exciting new movement for the rights of women. Too often that movement spoke for white women, but here, Abby Lincoln, the jazz singer, speaks for women of color.
We are the women who were kidnapped and brought to this continent as slaves. We are the women who were raped or still being raped, and our bastard children snatched from our breasts and scattered to the winds to be lynched, castrated, de-egoed, robbed, burned, and deceived. We are the women whose strong and beautiful black bodies were and are still being used as a cheap labor force for Miss Anne's kitchen and Mr. Charlie's bed, whose rich black and warm milk nurtured and still nurtures the heir to the racist and evil slave master. We are the women who dwell in the hellhole ghettos all over the land. We are the women whose bodies are sacrificed as living cadavers to experimental surgery in the white man's hospitals for the sake of white medicine. We are the women who are invisible on the television and movie screens and on the Broadway stage. We are the women who are lusted after, sneered at, leered at, hissed at, yelled at, grabbed at, tracked down by white degenerates in our own pitiable, poverty-stricken, and prideless neighborhoods. We are the women whose hair is compulsively fried, whose skin is bleached, whose nose is too big, whose mouth is too big and loud, whose behind is too big and broad, whose feet are too big and flat, whose face is too black and shiny, and whose suffering and patience is too long and enduring to be believed. Who are just too damn much for everybody. Who will revere the black woman? Who will keep our neighborhood safe for black innocent womanhood? Black womanhood is outraged and humiliated. Black womanhood cries for dignity and restitution and salvation. Black womanhood wants and needs protection and keeping and holding. Who will assuage her indignation? Who will keep her precious and pure? Who will glorify and proclaim her beautiful image? To whom will she cry rape?
Thank you. In the 60s, farm workers on the West Coast began to organize against the powerful growers. In 1966, the Farm Workers Union led a 300-mile march to Sacramento to call attention to the strike of grape workers. A national boycott of grapes was remarkably successful in forcing the growers to negotiate with the workers. Through it all, Cesar Chavez, president of the United Farm Workers of America, was a charismatic and effective leader. Here is a speech of his in 1989 calling attention to the plight of farm workers.
What is the worth of a man or a woman? What is the value of a farm worker? How do you measure the value of a life? Ask the parents of Johnny Rodriguez. Johnny Rodriguez wasn't even a man. Johnny was a 5-year-old boy when he died after a painful 2-year battle against cancer. His parents, Juan and Aaliyah, are farm workers. Like all grape workers, they are exposed to pesticides and other agricultural chemicals. Aaliyah worked in the table grapes around Delano, California, until she was 8 months pregnant with Johnny. The wealth and plenty of California agribusiness are built atop the suffering of generations of California farm workers. Farm labor history across America is one shameful tale after another of hardship and exploitation. Malnutrition among migrant children, tuberculosis, pneumonia, and respiratory infections, average life expectancy more than 20 years below the U.S. norm. When farm workers organize against these injustices, they are met with brutality and coercion and death. Who will protect farm workers from poisoning if it isn't the Farm Workers Union? The Environmental Protection Agency won't do it. The law won't do it. Oscar Wilde once said, "A cynic is someone who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing." We look at the price. We don't look at the value. Economics and profit drive everything. Do we carry in our hearts the suffering of farm workers and their children? Do we feel their pain deeply enough? The answer lies with you and me. It is with all men and women who share the suffering and yearn with us for a better world.
Early in 1991, President George Bush Sr. sent American troops into Iraq, presumably to liberate Kuwait from the control of Saddam Hussein, more likely to assure American power in the oil-rich countries of the Middle East. The government had learned from the Vietnam experience that an anti-war movement must not be allowed time to develop, that U.S. casualties must be kept low, and that information about the war must be controlled. A massive air attack quickly defeated the forces of Saddam Hussein, and the American people were kept ignorant of the large numbers of casualties among Iraqi civilians. Nevertheless, a protest movement developed, and there were refusals among the military to participate in the war. A Navy Reserve Corpsman named James Lawrence Harrington wrote a letter of resignation to his commander.
There comes a time in life when maintaining silence is but a betrayal of one's own spiritual core of being. Such a time has come, and I must declare from the expansion of my heart and over the limited sphere of my mind that I am a conscientious objector opposed to any and all wars. The power and command of my faith dictates that I work diligently and completely to stop war. To this end do I dedicate the efforts of my life. I do not hold that the absence of participation in war is itself a peace. Through the power of the people, peace is an active force that can and must spread to all nations, including our own. Our nation suffers from a deep malady in its consciousness that leads it down the path of continual violence and strife. I seek not only to stop this impending war in the Persian Gulf, but to also treat our own profound sickness. War is but a symptom of a greater concern. I prescribe the treatment of a radical revolution within our nation from that of a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented community. We must learn to love and respect all people for the sake of the divinity and basic goodness that dwells within them. When we deny people the right to exist and to self-determination, we are assuring our own self-destruction. In order to save my nation, and in order not to betray my own soul, I take this open stance of opposition to all wars.
The administration of Ronald Reagan began an attack on welfare, on aid to single mothers, on food stamps, on health care for the poor. That attack would culminate during the Clinton administration with the ending of federal guarantees to families with dependent children. In the early Reagan years, a mother wrote to a local newspaper responding to the claim that government was not needed, that private enterprise, the so-called free market, would take care of poverty.
I am an aide to families with dependent children, and both my children are in school. I have graduated from college with distinction, 128th in a class of over 1,000, with a BA in English and sociology. I have experience in library work, child care, social work, and counseling. I have applied for jobs paying as little as $8,000 a year. I work part-time in a library for $3.50 an hour. Welfare reduces my allotment to compensate. It appears we have employment offices that can't employ, governments that can't govern, and an economic system that can't produce jobs for people ready to work. Last week, I sold my bed to pay for the insurance on my car, while in the absence of mass transportation, I need to go job hunting. I sleep on a piece of rubber foam somebody gave me. So this is the great American dream my parents came to this country for. Work hard, get a good education, follow the rules, and you'll be rich. I don't want to be rich. I just want to be able to feed my children with some semblance of dignity.
Immediately after the terrorist attack on the Twin Towers and the Pentagon on September 11, 2001, President George Bush proclaimed a war on terrorism, and soon after began the bombardment of Afghanistan. But some of the families who had lost loved ones in the attack refused to support what the government was doing and formed a group called Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. The family of Phyllis and Orlando Rodriguez, whose son Greg was among the many missing from the World Trade Center, wrote to the New York Times, "We sense that our government is heading in a direction of violent revenge. It is not the way to go. It will not avenge our son's death, not in our son's name." A woman named Amber Amundson sent a statement to the Chicago Tribune.
"My husband, Craig Scott Amundson of the U.S. Army, lost his life in the line of duty at the Pentagon on September 11th as the world looked on in horror and disbelief. Losing my 28-year-old husband and father of our two young children is a terrible and painful experience. I have heard angry rhetoric by some Americans, including some of our nation's leaders, who advise a heavy dose of revenge and punishment. To those leaders, I would like to make clear that my family and I take no comfort in your words of rage. If you choose to respond to this incomprehensible brutality by perpetuating violence against other innocent human beings, you may not do so in the name of my husband. Craig would not have wanted a violent response to avenge his death. And I cannot see how good can come of it. We cannot solve violence by violence. Mohandas Gandhi said, an eye for an eye only makes the whole world blind. I call upon our nation's leaders to find the courage to respond to this incomprehensible tragedy by breaking the cycle of violence. I call on them to marshal this great nation's skills and resources to lead a worldwide dialogue from freedom, from terror and hate.